Welcome to the Daily Canon Podcast.
Hello again, listeners. It's another Daily Canon Weekly Podcast. It's a bit of a mixed emotions, Daily Canon Weekly Podcast, because obviously quite a lot has happened in the last week. We've had the pleasure of a League Cup Gold Fest away at Anfield, which sadly didn't turn out the right way, and the frustration of a non-Gold Fest at home to Wolves, and some other things going on around the club. And of course, we have a load of listeners' questions that we'll be getting to a little bit later on in the pod. And joining me to do all that is, as always, podcast regular Anita Sambol. How are you, Anita?
Hello, Matthew. I'm doing okay, still thinking about the Liverpool match because I would say sadly, but probably not sadly, missed the Wolves match over the weekend.
Well, I didn't have the pleasure of watching the Liverpool match live because I was in a very long and not always interesting meeting and therefore only came out just in time to see the end of the penalty shootout.
So the worst part.
I got the good bits. But obviously, there's a lot to talk about this week, so we'll try and rattle on, particularly as we should have some updates about the women's team coming in from Sylvain as well. So without further ado, rather than, as per usual, starting miserably and getting happier, let's start with the Liverpool game.
Yay!
So obviously, you saw this in its entirety, Anita. So give me your thoughts on it before I then start babbling on my own opinions.
Well, I mean, first when we saw that Mesut Ozil is in fact traveling to Anfield and will probably play and start the match, that was just really fantastic news and great thing to see. And then when the lineups came out and we saw that Liverpool are playing with their second string team, is it even second string team? Maybe like youths more than the second string team.
Well, the midfield was pretty strong.
Oh, yeah, James Milner was playing, yeah.
You had Milner, Oxlade-Chamberlain, Naby Keita and Adam Lallana.
Yeah.
So, you know, decent.
A mix.
Yeah, yeah.
Similar, like our team.
Yeah, exactly.
And it all looks well. I mean, I actually forgot that it started on half an hour mark, I think. I thought it will be on the, like, quarter of an hour, like usually in the midweek game. So I happily missed the Mustafi own goal at the beginning of the match, and it was just like, oh, not this again.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was a really thrilling match and fantastic. We saw a couple of really fantastic goals on each side, and Mesut Ozil was just amazing once again, showing how important he can be. Martinelli, I mean, are there any words to say how good of a find he is turning out to be? And again, the substitutions made by our head coach that I think really killed our chances and made us lose the match in dying minutes once again, as it often happens against Liverpool, conceding a goal in added time.
Well, what I will say is, given the substitutions in the game at Anfield, it turns out they actually were with a greater purpose for once, because obviously Torreira and Ozil started the game against in the Premier League at the weekend, and therefore at least taking them off at Anfield had a broader sense to it, rather than just perhaps some of the substitutions in the Wolves game, but we'll get on to that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, during the match, it looked like, what the hell are you doing? Taking out our most creative players when it didn't look really well. And after the match as well, you know, when I read his comments that he decided that he will sub off Mesut Ozil at the 1 hour mark, even before the match, it didn't seem like a good game management to me. I think that's something like that. I understand that he made that decision before the match because, I mean, we have to be realistic, Mesut didn't play as much at all and probably wasn't completely match fit for all of that. But I thought that you can make an exception, perhaps, you know, to see how the match is going and not base a substitution based on something you thought about 2 days before the match, but to see how the things are happening in the match and then make a sub like that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I mean,
I didn't see the game live, so I only really got the flow of the game. But I do have, obviously, a certain amount of knowledge about the stats. And it was notable that Arsenal only had two shots on goal after Ozil went off.
Yes.
One of which was a 30-yard thunder bastard from Joe Willock, which I don't think anyone would have seen coming. And also that Ozil, despite going off that early, had the most passes on the pitch, even at the game's end, by some distance, with a, think it was a 94% pass completion rate.
I mean, just fantastic.
And even though Liverpool had a lot of pressure towards the end of the game and eventually got their last gasp equaliser, Arsenal still finished the game with more than double the XG that Liverpool had. That's expected goals for those of you not into the stats, which basically means we created more and better chances. And I mean, what before we sort of get too far down the Unai Emery rabbit hole, what did you make of the game itself? Obviously, Liverpool, should we say, relied slightly more on great goals. Or poor, well, as much on poor officiating, but just that we got our benefit from the linesman and they got theirs from the referee.
Well, it looked like on our side, like one of the Europa League performances where the players really looked motivated and youngsters were playing really well. But I thought that we benefited a lot from their young goalkeeper and defense that hasn't been playing together much, and in a few goals you can see that they were struggling with there were deflections and everything, and obviously the first goal was offside and would definitely not be given by the VAR. But then again, you have to wonder if they would get the penalty.
No. Total dive. Shameless dive. They teach them young at Anfield. Yeah, he's only been there for about 4 months and they're already teaching him to fall over in the box.
I was watching the highlights today on Arsenal player to remind myself of the match, and they didn't even show the replay of the penalty call.
Oh, I've seen
just,
it.
Just, really. You know, he fell and then there's a penalty. And I definitely remember that it was a dive.
Yeah, no, I've seen the replay from a few different angles. And yeah, let's just say he made the most of contact that wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, the match itself was, as I say, fun for the neutral.
Yeah.
My boss asked me after the day later, what the hell was that? Can we even talk about the match? Are you angry? I'm like, no, I'm not angry. I mean, we didn't look so bad. It was really entertaining. And if we have to lose, I'd rather lose when we are this fun and this close and this entertaining than, you know, like we did against Wolf. I mean, we lost some penalties, but, you know, to get to the draw, while being so entertaining and fun and scoring goals for fun rather than clinching for the 1-0 draw, 1-0 win until the last dying seconds of the match.
I mean, as some wag posted out on Twitter, and by wag I don't mean in the wags and wives and girlfriends capacity, so that only Arsenal could be winning 5-4 and then lose 5-4.
Yeah, I mean, we scored 5 goals at Anfield and didn't go through. That's just really frustrating. Emi Martinez, I love him. I really like the guy, but
not his best game.
I mean, he dived on the wrong side every single time.
I mean, I can't help thinking there's a couple of the goals they scored that he might want back as well.
Yeah, true.
I mean, I thought that both with Origi's last-minute equaliser, and to be honest, possibly even, I mean, it was very unlucky, but even the own goal he could have potentially done slightly better with, but I've got a bit more sympathy for him on that. Obviously, in between, we had the ghost of Oxlade-Chamberlain coming in.
That was just a fantastic goal.
I mean, I've seen some people being a little bit critical of Maitland-Niles because obviously the Ox pinched the ball ahead of him, but I think in that situation you have to give credit to the attacking player, because where Oxlade-Chamberlain got to the ball, it would have been very difficult for Maitland-Niles to get anything substantial on the ball anyway in that position. It was just excellent initiative, attacking play from a player who's on a bit of a goal-scoring run for Liverpool at the moment, having coming back to fitness, and you know, is showing the things that we all liked about him most at Arsenal, but never saw with any consistency.
Yeah. And then Joe Willock went on the other side and showed he can do it as well.
Yeah, with an absolutely ridiculous goal. I mean, we have to give some serious love, as you sort of mentioned, to Ozil's role. I mean, two assists and a pre-assist.
The famous Ozil pre-assist.
Yeah, I mean, that the one where he won the ball back from their defender and then the first time flicked through to Saka, who then crossed it for Martinelli, was brilliant. But obviously...
just what he's there to do.
The Maitland-Niles one was fun as well, because Ozil made something, again, very difficult look very easy.
Yeah, that was just... the whole Twitter went crazy. Oh, stop it, Messi. That's filthy. Just really fantastic. I mean...
And definitely, it was very clear to see that there was something that he provided that had been, you know, even though that Europa League team has been pretty cool to watch all season, there's something, the qualities that he has that this team has been missing. You know, we all know Ozil well enough to know where the holes are in his game and what he can't do. And it's, you know, he's become a better and better player the more he's been out of the team. But so it's nice to actually see some concrete physical evidence of what he can do rather than just our romantic imaginations being the driving force.
Yeah, he proved us right. Well, us who have been saying that he definitely deserves some minutes and has to play, even more so in the Wolves match as well.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, just the level of control he had in the Liverpool game, as I say, with those pass completion stats and the amount of passes and the fact that he directly contributed to three goals, it's hard not to like. Apparently, also showing the madcap nature of the game, that was the highest expected goals that there's been under Unai Emery, and indeed the highest has been for 2 years for Arsenal.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, so basically, I mean, if you look at just the game stats, Arsenal should have won comfortably. But, you know, this being Arsenal, we found a way not to. Before I start talking about some of our weaknesses, what did you make of seeing, I suppose, a vision that pleased a lot of people, which is young Hector as captain?
Yes, that was really, really great thing to see. From the minute one when he gave his jacket to the little mascot that was cold while walking down the pitch, that was just really... very nice thing to do. And then there was that situation where I'm not sure which goals it was, when Mesut Ozil was like alone in the middle of the pitch waiting, and Hector was there to, you know, ask him what's happening and get him involved with the team as well. And after the match, the interview I was watching today that he gave, talking about how he is disappointed but very proud with the team, it's just... like, you know, doing exactly what we expected him to do as a captain, because you have this perception of him off the pitch, which we have seen building for the last year or so while he was out injured, with all the interviews he has done and the little video log that he has been recording on his YouTube and comments on that conference he was attending as well. Mm. So... definitely show that he is exactly the kind of person, I'd say more than a player, the person that you think he would be. I'm still not sure if he's if he can be the full-time captain, because he does lack experience in that field and it's a really big role, but he has definitely all the prepositions for that.
Yeah, and also I like the fact that, you know, after the own goal, he went over and, you know, tried to cheer Mustafi up a bit. For what, you know, I mean, Mustafi looked like he wanted the ground to swallow him up, but it was. I mean, I had real sympathy for him that one. It was just a bit unlucky.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, throughout the game, obviously, our central defence was not watertight, but, you know, having said that, I think Holding was as at fault for any of the other goals as Mustafi was, and possibly to some degree more so. Dropping off a bit too far for Origi and also letting himself be turned a bit too easily, I thought. From what I've seen of the highlights, obviously didn't see the game, it looked like Holding was showing the rustiness you'd expect for someone that has really not played very much and has been out for such a long period of time. And let's face it, was only just really establishing himself as a potential first choice defender just as he got injured. You know, a lot of people have been sort of hailing him as the saviour, and I guess I've been guilty of that at times, but it's all, with both him and Hector, it's going to take a while before they're really at that level.
But I mean, it's human. When a team is struggling, you always think that the players that are missing for one reason or another are definitely those who will improve, who would be helpful if they were there. It happens all the time.
Exactly. And, you know, perhaps, and at their best, I think we'd be justified in thinking that. But we have to remember that the kind of injuries both players have recovered from are the kind of injuries that always take a good chunk of time to really come back from. And if there's one thing I'll say in defence of the head coach, you know, not rushing these players back too much, I'm very much in favour of, particularly with their age and not wanting to do them any longer-term damage. Because, you know, we saw that was one thing that Wenger was sometimes a bit guilty of, is bringing players back too quickly. And in certain cases, that did lead to them having more problems down the line. I mean, you know, Danny Welbeck was a case in point when he got that second serious knee injury, when he was back a little bit. He didn't, you know, you were kind of slightly worried about him being fully up to speed, and he played it, you know, a couple of games in a row, and then immediately, bang, was out again for another how many months.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that whether it's Unai Emery's personal choice, whether it's on the club, at least someone is approaching the situation with slightly more long-term thinking, which isn't always the case in other situations. So then before we get to the league game against Wolverhampton Wanderers, a couple of things I wanted to say from the Liverpool game. At that stage, that meant that Martinelli's goal record was equal to the best of any Brazilian in Europe, apart from, equal to Ronaldo, the original one, in terms of his first seven games and first few starts. So, uber congrats to him, as you alluded to. And it was nice to see Saka after having, you know, as fun, obviously having that disappointment in the Premier League with, you know, refereeing decisions going against him and chances not being converted by his teammates. So it's nice to see him getting a nice clear assist as well. So we leave that game behind, and then we get the long-awaited Xhaka press release.
I hope I forgot about that as well.
Well, like I said, there's been
unlike
a lot going
many
on.
Other fans.
Yeah. I mean, bearing in mind that we now know that part of it had been slightly mistranslated, and that actually, rather than saying, I'm sorry if that's what people thought, the actual correct translation was, that was not my intention and I'm sorry, which is what it actually said in German, as opposed to whatever idiot translated it on Instagram for him and got it correct and made him sound more like he was being a passive-aggressive bitch than actually remotely contrite.
And Arsenal printed it like that again in the program for Wolves.
Yeah, not great. And there does seem to be some, you know, the delay has been backed up by rumblings of disagreement between the player and the club about what should be said. And now I know some people have been implying that it's because Xhaka's been less willing to admit culpability because he's so pissed off. Other people have been implying that the club have been worried about his mental health. But then there's been other rumours flying around that actually he doesn't feel there's anything to worry about his mental health, and he's pissed off that anyone at the club suggested, you know, that Emery might have suggested there may have been an issue there. So there's a lot of different information, misinformation, is it information at all, going on. So all I can really ask you is, what did you make of the statement? Let's give it the charitable interpretation of the actual translation rather than the what we originally saw. And where do you think that leaves him going forward?
Well, I didn't expect much from the statement. I'm glad that he put it out, because there has been a long time of waiting. Will he, won't he, will club say anything, will Xhaka apologize, or what will happen? And I was pretty okay with that statement that came out. I didn't expect him to apologize, because as we talked in podcast last week as well, I understood his point of view to some point, you know. And I thought that it was a good statement, informed that he actually said his side of things, the things that he witnessed on social media, his poor wife and newborn daughter witnessed as well, which was often said by fans who defended those who were abusive that it was just one or two fans who perhaps maybe tweeted him something, like maybe left a few abusive comments. But I'm glad that he put that in his statement to show that it definitely hurt him and got to him, and he saw that, and he always sees comments like that. It has to be highlighted as well. As I said, I didn't expect any apology. I think it was a pretty okay statement, and I wish that it was just, you know, put behind and moved on.
And so what do you think about, I suppose, his position in the leadership group? Because obviously Unai Emery has done his best to once again avoid making any actual fucking decisions. And, you know, has been, you know, whether we don't know what's true, what's not true. There's been a lot of stuff coming out this week that we have no idea of the veracity of, that seems to be a slight Emery character assassination. But it does seem that there's corroborated from a number of sources that either he consulted the players about their thoughts on it, or wanted to test the temperature, shall we say, of his squad, and not upset things further, because obviously Xhaka's very popular. He has friends across different friendship groups, and he's well respected amongst the players. But my fear is, a bit like with the original captaincy appointment in the first place, the more it's left slightly in limbo, that has dangers as well. You know, you're hoping that it makes the problem kind of slightly go away, but it has dangers associated with it as well.
Well, yeah, definitely. As you mentioned, players really do rate him highly and have him as a leader in the team. And I mean, just like with the decision on the captain or the five captains, he waits and waits to see. Maybe it will resolve itself in the end. But yeah, I would like to say that I expected him to do something, but I really didn't, because that's what he does. Doesn't say much on press conferences and everything. I said last week and still stand by it, I think that he should be stripped of the captaincy, even though I agree with things he did. Not agree with, to say it like that, but, yeah, you know, understand his point of view. But he still did insult the Arsenal fans who were in the stadium, and that really shouldn't be allowed for a captain.
Yeah, it's a sad situation, really, isn't it? Because it's just one of those ones where you have sympathy for him, but he's still, I suppose, in keeping with what we've seen him on the pitch, he reacted with a lack of composure that you need to be the captain of a massive football club, particularly in this social media age where, let's face it, you're going to get horrific abuse from some fucking melts, regardless what you do. And I know that it will hurt him, because I know that he was, you know, we've all heard how extremely proud he was to be Arsenal captain, and how he's really invested in the club. But perhaps, you know, I think certainly keeping him out of the captaincy highlight for a time being would be no bad thing. I suppose the difficulty is there's no one else that's as nearly as obvious a character as a club captain, as we've said before. So I would not be surprised if Emery just tries not to mention the issue again and just picks different captains on a sort of rotating basis for individual matches. That's kind of what I'm expecting at this stage.
Yeah, and Xhaka will probably still do the captain's notes in the matchday program.
Yes. We'll have to see. But yeah, it seems like there's reluctance to change that, and there we are. So
I have to say that one thing that really, I should say, disappointed me or made me a bit, you know, sad, because I have always been on Xhaka's side, is how he changed all of his profile picture on Instagram and removed mentions of Arsenal from the picture and from his Instagram bio and everything. That was just like,
yeah, again, his reaction is entirely understandable, but it shows a sort of lack of maturity.
Yeah, exactly, like if you're in high school or something.
Yeah, I mean, hey, I can only imagine what it'd be like to receive the level of abuse that he has, you know, basically being constantly criticised at your place of work, told that you're no good despite the fact that you're incredibly dedicated and hardworking, and then being given abuse from random strangers on the internet of the most vile kind. I mean, yeah, Christ, that's got to be really hard. But the one thing you don't do in that situation is then go onto social media and do anything, because that's going to be interpreted, it's going to be read, it's going to have repercussions. And, you know, it's like one of those things where it's not going to endear him to anyone that was questioning him in the first place. It's only going to make those positions more entrenched, and it might lose him some of the sympathy from the equally large or perhaps larger numbers of people who are supportive. So, yeah, it's unfortunate, and I hope that that gets reversed. Not that it's important in the grand scheme of things, but, you know, when you're in such a high-profile position and a high-profile role, you have to be able to manage yourself with dignity even if no one else is. And that's one of the really challenging things about being in a really high-profile public role. I mean, I've never had anything, obviously, as equivalent, but I have been a couple of times put in positions where I've had a figurehead role of some description, and it's affected either tens, hundreds, or thousands of people, depending on the individual role. You know, not necessarily affected them really, but they know who you are, they know what your job is, and you just have to take the shit, and you've just got to make sure that whatever you do, you retain your dignity and composure, and that's just what comes with the role. Now, it's, you know, it's easy for me to say because I'm not as combative a character as Granit Xhaka clearly is, and I'm obviously now, where some of those leadership elements come into play, I'm considerably older than he is. But I had my first experience when I was 21, so 22, and that's, you know, again, it wasn't as emotional or important, but I still had an environment where everyone in that environment knew what my role was, and I was the number one go-to for quite a lot of people on certain issues. And I just had to wear it. And if he wants to be a captain of a really, really big club, whether it be Arsenal or anywhere else in the future, he's got to recognise that that's just what the role is. That said, I do think that he has been dropped in the shit by Unai Emery. I mean, we all thought that Xhaka was exposed under Wenger, but we hadn't seen nothing yet.
Hold my beer, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Because at least under Wenger, Xhaka was able to be as part of a more attacking team, and so his more positive qualities could be more demonstrated. So even though we saw all the weaknesses, they were slightly offset more by seeing more of his positive qualities. But what we're seeing under Unai Emery, not only is he left just as exposed without the right partner, but he is not getting to really showcase his other talents, because the way the team is set up doesn't really give him as many passing options, which is obviously, we all know, is his greatest strength. I think, as using it as a link, the one thing we can say is the performance against Wolves, it was proof perfect that Xhaka really isn't to blame for the stodgy and non-functioning performances of our central midfield over the last year, because he wasn't there and not a lot changed.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely. I suppose some, I wouldn't say many, but some fans definitely expected things to, you know, magically work now that Xhaka was being left out, which I think was really a good idea to, you know, keep him out of the spotlight.
Oh yeah, God, yeah.
And but it didn't work.
And also, it kind of put the captaincy question away. It made, you know, you don't want him going on the pitch if he's not quite in the right, you know, if he's still fucked off about things, which he's, you know, got every reason to potentially be. And I think also, with the pressure that's come with the captaincy, the fans' reaction, I think Xhaka's form, quite apart from the tactical clusterfuck around him, I think his form has actually suffered a bit. And I think it was probably not a bad time for him to come out of the team, regardless of what happened. And it meant that the game could, or at least at the start of the game, could be about the return to the starting lineup of the of the German hero, who obviously was. We were playing a number 10, but of course, Unai Emery being Unai Emery, we couldn't play a number 10 behind a front three. Oh no! That was far too much to fucking ask. So we went back to our four diamond two. which we discovered last season works really well if you've got Aaron Ramsey.
Yeah.
But he's currently sitting on the injury list in Juventus.
I mean, just when you think we will finally get to see Ozil playing with Aubameyang, Pepe and Lacazette, not going to happen.
Well, it was sort of like, I found it as a very depressing vindication of what I'd said on a previous podcast, in that it's as much Pepe's emergence that has been partly giving the excuse to not play Ozil, because they do have a similar function. You know, Pepe had been our primary creative player prior to that. You know, he's all left foot, likes to drift out to the right, can drift a bit more centrally, likes to beat a man, likes to play those lofted crossfield passes into the penalty area. But I would have thought, under the circumstances, given the game that it was, surely playing both was, you can play players together that are stylistically similar. I can understand why you might see them as alternatives, but they don't have to be alternatives, and unless you're a manager that really, really, really likes a flat midfield three with no pace.
How lucky are we?
How lucky are we? And once again, we got to see the joy of Lucas Torreira running around in an advanced central midfield role, getting nowhere near the fucking ball because we've got no structure to our play, and you know, most of the balls in those areas are either spread out wide or are kind of become sort of battling with bigger central midfielders. So I felt really sorry for Torreira in this game, because he'd been so good against Liverpool by all accounts, and in this game he spent the first half mostly just watching the ball go around him, and he was just kind of running up and down the pitch without any real ability to impact the play. I mean, I think we can all see that the logic between trying to play him as advanced midfield, you know, let's try and win the ball high up, press the opposition, blah, 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 blah. But we can all see that the theory not only doesn't work, but it hasn't ever really looked like it might work.
Anyone but Emery, huh?
Well, yes, but I mean, we all know that managers love a blind spot, and we'll get onto that in due course. But
I saw some tweets saying how Torreira was actually playing in front of Ozil quite a few times.
Yeah. Well, he was, definitely. I mean, Ozil was, obviously, as he likes to do, was dropping deep and getting on the ball. And as Torreira wasn't there as a feeding option at that point in time, Ozil was having to drop deep. And of course, you know, Wolves are a decent team, and they've got a decent defence. They've got a very good midfield, as we all know, particularly in central areas. So there wasn't a lot of space there to be had. And as always happens when we have the diamond, we had no width. Diamond split strikers, only one of our really, really attacking wing-backs, full-backs, no width. I mean, obviously, you've only seen the highlights and the Adrian Clark breakdown. I mean, what did you glean from those?
Well, one thing that really stood with me during watching the match on Twitter and seeing the reaction posts that, and then highlights, stats and breakdown by Adrian, it's the second half. Mm-hmm. And how bad we were in second half. Like, we had 3 shots. None of them in on target, and 2 were from set pieces.
Yeah, and the second half was, once again, it was we didn't have a particularly good first half, but it was a decent first half, a nice goal, obviously, Laka and Oba combining again.
Yeah, in highlights, it was, in the first half, it was just basically us. It was their few chances in the opening few minutes.
Mm.
And then mostly Arsenal chances after that.
Yeah, which is pretty much how it was live. You know, I mean, Wolves were very strong early on. We looked a bit shaky. We seemed to struggle matching up the formation. Then we seemed to get our balance a little bit better, place them to be slightly more certain where they are.
As Lee would say, players forget what Emery said to them and played as they know.
Well, I think it's also that, you know, if you're playing a different fucking formation every week, no matter how much you practice it in training, it always takes a little while to adjust to it when there's actually an opposition playing you, particularly when it's an opposition who have very different strengths and weaknesses to your own players that you might be training against. But, yeah, I mean, we sort of took control of the first half without ever really being dominant. You know, we looked quite comfortable. We looked like we might score again, but it wasn't quite happening. And then we had half time, and then Wolves came out strongly again.
As it's happened so many times this season.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that we were awful in the second half in terms of looking really weak. We just were just meh. Yeah, just a lot of meh. But we looked like we might hold on for a 1-0 or maybe squeak a second on the counter. You know, Ozil had a couple of dangerous moments where he's creating chances and half chances and what have you. That didn't really come to anything, but they always looked like the threat was there. And then came the substitutions. I mean, you are the Twitter queen. So, what did you notice about the reactions to those online?
No, I haven't seen that.
Ah, well, I'm trying to get the order of these right. We had Martinelli come on for Lacazette, which Lacazette, you know, hasn't played that many full-time games, is tiring a bit. So it's then we moved. So then Martinelli moved out, sort of to the right-ish. And Oba went central. Well, Martinelli sort of was playing left, right, and centre, but only briefly, because not long after that, Torreira came off and Bukayo Saka came on, playing on the left wing, which then meant obviously that Martinelli did go to the right, where he has never played for us before. Of course, when our 72 million right-sided attacking midfielder who set up 3 goals and scored 2 in his previous 4 games is sitting on the bench.
That's a reward, right?
Yeah.
Relax on the bench.
Yeah, yes, exactly. You finally started having a major impact in games. Good. Well done. Have an ice cream and some comics. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I was not the only person at that point in time just going, yeah, we love Saka and Martinelli and they are the future, but like, what? Like, what the fuck are you doing? You know, he plays Pepe relentlessly through his poor form, or where he's struggling to make an impact in the team and his confidence is low. Then the player finally has a massive impact and his confidence is high. So we drop him completely.
Yeah.
That's
the way to go.
And then don't bring him off the bench because, I mean, I know Saka was partly because he was a bit worried about Wolves' right-hand side because Traore and Doherty were causing us some problems. But then Doherty started struggling with an injury and he still did the same bloody thing. Mm-hmm. And of course, very soon after that, Wolves get their equaliser because Danny Ceballos is incapable of tracking runners, which we kind of knew anyway.
Yeah, he didn't look behind him.
Yeah, he didn't look behind him and also just wasn't really concentrating at the throw-in. And also, you know, after that great show against Burnley, Ceballos, he's a decent footballer, but he is quite one-paced and he's not defensively minded. And so if he's not in a setup that really helps him, he just ends up looking very average, which is what happened against Wolves at the weekend. And of course, you're chasing the win, but you're also not wanting to concede. So you bring on an 18-year-old and then you take off your defensive midfielder when you've got an attacking midfielder who hasn't really influenced the game. I mean, it's just, yeah, it becomes kind of increasingly incomprehensible.
So and the third sub.
And the third sub?
I've seen the reaction to that.
I mean, the third sub was Kolasinac on for Tierney, which I could see Tierney was tiring and they were getting some joy down our left. But they've just equalised. It's 1-1. We should be going for the fucking win, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, unless, you know, Tierney didn't appear to be injured. He just appeared to be tiring. So, yeah, it's kind of another hard read, that one. I mean, is there anything else you'd like to say about that game?
Well, Adrian Clark was full of praise for Mesut Ozil again.
Standard.
How he bossed the match. He had the most passes in final third, the most key passes, everything. Just, yeah, definitely shows once again that he had to be playing up until now.
Yeah. Well, also just that, you know, just the having a slightly different team shape. I mean, even though it still wasn't what we wanted, because hey, but it, at least it gave us a connector somewhere in vaguely centrally in the final third. It gave us someone whose desire is to get on the ball in that position. Because without Ozil, the entire pressure for that lands on Lacazette fighting for scraps, as he does quite effectively against much bigger centre halves. Because you've got Aubameyang who doesn't want the ball, but Aubameyang wants to get to the ball as late on in the move as possible and then kill things off. You got
his goal was really. You can see that he's a definitely world class striker.
Yeah, he made it look so chill, didn't he?
Yeah.
And yet, even as another option, you got Pepe, but who's an overtly creative player who likes the ball to feet. But he is equally, he's a wide player, so there's a limited number of areas of the pitch he's going to be able to connect in. But beyond that, there's no one, and it's been the problem all season, there's been no one playing that connector role in the final third. Particularly with Lacazette out, because before at least you had, Iwobi and Mkhitaryan have their issues, but they were ball transitioners, but who actually wanted the ball. They wanted to carry the ball, they wanted to pass the ball into those areas, they wanted to play those kind of accelerating the play type manoeuvres. You know, neither of them are really good enough, and Iwobi's not tearing up too many trees at Everton, but he tried to do things that would progress the team in an attacking sense. You've got an ice cream van there.
sorry, TV okay. Turned on. Sorry.
In the absence of Ozil this season, no Ramsey either. There's literally been no one performing that function at all, which is why we've been so, comparatively easy to defend against, except if we've got a quick counter and we can use our pace. And just having Ozil in the team, he wasn't at his very best, and Wolves defended pretty well, but it just reminded you of what a tactical vacuum there's been in that area. And suddenly we were having passes advanced in the middle third, which, if you look at our pass maps for most of this season, there's been vast chasms of fuck all 30 yards out from their goal. And of course, that's a position on the pitch where the opposition don't want you to have the ball because it's dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. It was just in the breakdown, it was just so nice to see Ozil's passes, through the lines, seeing players going somewhere where no one else will see them. Just really fantastic things to see, and something we have been craving and missing.
but also, really simply, just someone with the technical security and confidence to keep the ball in the opposition final third. Even if he's not doing anything with it, even if he's just doing his gentle probing, it just helps us have slightly more control. Now, that said, we were still a tactical clusterfuck because Wolves had twice as many shots as us in this game, almost.
Yeah,
and yet another team to have 20 shots against this season.
At home,
yeah.
Just crazy.
I mean, only Watford have had more chances against us this season. Watford, who are still bottom, is that right?
I mean, they didn't show many of those shots on the highlights, so I assume they weren't all, that dangerous. They were just counted as shots instead. But still, you allow players to get in those positions and have a go at the goal.
Yeah.
It's just crazy.
I mean, the way we're set up at the moment, Frank Lampard would have scored every fucking time against us just by having that volume of shots from outside the box. And it's really hard to pinpoint exactly where the issue is, apart from the fact that our backline is slightly too deep, because David Luiz likes to play slightly deeper than, say, some of our other defenders in the past. And also the midfield balance and shape still isn't right, and we're conceding too much possession, we're conceding too much territory. Emery wants us to be a transition team, so obviously if you do that, you don't want to be on the ball all the time in the opposition third. But at the same time, we're also a big club, and using superior technical assurity is a great way to wear teams down, especially at home. And we all know that Mesut Ozil away at Old Trafford in November or February isn't optimum Ozil time. But we also equally know that him at home against a slightly weaker team, that's his fucking gravy, bread and butter, man. I mean, his record of producing things at home against slightly weaker teams is exceptional. But anyway, no doubt we'll have more about that. So that leaves us still in fifth place because everyone else appears to be shit that are below us, but increasingly falling behind Leicester City and Chelsea, who both won again quite impressively.
I'm just so worried about the match against Leicester.
Yes, well, of course, as this game ended, there were more boos at full time. And
yes, that was shown in highlights as well.
And lots of people, including to a hopefully measured degree myself, but I don't always know if that's true, have been losing their fucking shit. And basically, yeah, you know, I have to admit, I did tweet a couple of time for Emery to go messages out, including one where I tagged Arsenal. Strange enough, I didn't respond. But also lots of people talking about how unified the fan base is, because basically no one really wants, you know, people have different views about how soon he should be gone, but no, I haven't heard or met from anyone that thinks that he's the guy to take us forward.
Yeah.
And when that starts happening in a fan base, you've got to turn things around very quickly or it's tick, 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 boom.
Well, he managed to do that, unify the fan base, if nothing else.
Yeah, which I suppose is easier said than done of late. So, yeah, I mean, we have to talk about the broader discussion, and then we'll move on to a couple other things after that. But, I mean, is there anything to add for yourself from where we left off before on this one?
But when should he go?
Yeah, I mean, I like the way that the question is when, not if.
I mean, as you said, we all agree that whatever his plan is definitely not working for us at the moment, and I don't see it happening in the future. There were some rumors going around today on Monday after the match that the board and everyone at the club are willing to give him some more chance and wait for him to, you know, get stuff right, get things working because of the Europa League final, where we lost 4-1.
Yeah, I heard that story too. I think there's been a lot of things coming out of the press in the last few days since that game, which are just different people bullshitting, because we've heard so many stories about, you know, the board think this, the board think that. This is the Arsenal board. You know, unless you are like one of, about, unless you hear it from Ornstein or one or two others, you know it's bullshit. Because they're not telling anyone. Look, why the hell would they tell people we're giving it this long? No, the only thing the board are ever going to say is we still stand behind our manager, right up until the moment where they fucking don't.
Yeah,
we all know that's how it works at every club, and so all the speculation, people can, you know, people. I know I've seen a lot of people on Twitter getting excited or angry or this, that, or the other about it. It's like, don't listen to these journalists. They're just trying to sell you papers or get clicks on their website. They don't know. Unless it's one of a very small number of people, they don't know shit. But
I did like the one where they said that Arsenal categorically declined any connections with Jose Mourinho.
Well, I was going to say, I'm sure we're going to have some questions about that from what I've seen about the Mourinho rumours. But yeah, it was quite funny, actually. There was obviously that Duncan Castle story out coming out in the newspapers, who isn't at all Mourinho's mouthpiece and hasn't at all been Mourinho's bitch in the press for the last few years. But, before the Arsenal came out with their statement, I did quite enjoy rebuffing a number of people saying, it's bollocks. It's bollocks. Sanier hasn't spoken to Mourinho for years. The Arsenal board wouldn't hire Mourinho under any circumstances, because they know that'd be one way to start the new fan base united. And also, there are a lot of other decent potential candidates out there at the moment. You know, we can add Niko Kovac to the list after this weekend.
Let's not.
Are you not a fan of Kovac then?
I was just reading on OneFootball what Luis Ambrose wrote about situation at Bayern and how he described what was happening for Niko Kovac at Bayern and everything. It's just exactly what we are having right now. Not really going forward well, in the team during the matches. Like, he literally said, like, Bayern have become an aimless team, reliant on their superior talent to see them through games, grinding out wins that they should be claiming easily, dropping points that they should be more than capable of collecting.
I mean,
that's us right now.
Well, there is one crucial difference, of course, is that Bayern Munich won the fucking Bundesliga last year. and have just humiliated Spurs in the Champions League. So I know they have slightly higher expectations, given that they can basically buy whoever they want in Germany, except for like childhood Dortmund fans. But at the same time, this is a manager who did start badly last season, actually probably worse than he started this season, and then won the fucking league. So, you know, that shows how ruthless they are.
He did offer his resignation and it was accepted, so it was him who pulled the trigger.
Well, by mutual...
At least that's the story.
That's the story, yes. I can imagine Uli Hoeneß tried so hard to convince him to stay. but obviously, you know, there are plenty of others. Allegri's the obvious candidate of someone who's very high profile. But, you know,
been on our list for years.
But the Arsenal job is a big job.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of people who would quite happily leave wherever they are now to take that one up. I did enjoy the latest suggestion I heard this week that Chris Wilder from Sheffield United, as they showed footage of Sheffield United passing the ball around Burnley like Burnley aren't there, which I thought was kind of interesting, because at the end, you know, one cannot deny that he's been amazing with them, but also they're his childhood team, so there is a sort of extra level of connection.
I have seen really worryingly low number of mentions of Eddie Howe.
Yeah, well, it's because Bournemouth are kind of this weird team that they go through periods of being on really good form and they go through periods of being on really crap form, and they seem really inconsistent. And so even though they're still punching possibly slightly above their weight in the grand scheme of things and they play decent football, it's kind of, it hasn't really kicked on that much since a few years ago. You know, we're always on people that are on the way up rather than people who are just stagnant. And I guess the jury's out on Eddie Howe on that one. But it's difficult, because how can he prove himself unless he gets a bigger job? I saw a stat that was out today that by Emery's last 18 games, we are on course for a season average of 51 points, which would have us 11th in the table at the end of last season.
Yeah, last 18, it was 6 wins, 6 draws and 6 losses. And those 6 wins don't seem like big ones. I mean, they were all grind out wins, struggling to retain the 3 points.
Yeah, it's true. It's get to the point where, you know, we've all compared it to the last season and a half under Arsene Wenger, where the wheels well and truly came off. There are a lot of similarities, not just in terms of personnel, but also tactical failures, uncertainty about how to get the balance right between attacking and defending, etc. But the fundamental difference has to be the fact that Arsene Wenger had, despite disappointments at times, a lot more credit in the bank. Arsene Wenger, you know, when his teams aren't playing well, he's an excellent communicator, very charming and erudite. He had won amazing things with us, and even though things went off the boil, he'd still produced the best football that any Arsenal fan has ever seen and may ever will see. And he had shown himself to have a very strong connection with the club. So, you know, even though things got really toxic towards the end, and there was a question that refers to that later, which we'll come on to, he had got himself a position within the fan base's heart that it was always going to take quite a while for people to really totally turn on him. But Unai Emery hasn't got any of those things at all. You know, he had the novelty of being something different, and he talked a good game when he first turned up, and we saw some signs that we enjoyed at the first half of last season, where he appeared to be implementing things which are what we wanted to see as changes in the team. But, I mean, I suppose the question I saw recently, which I thought was quite apt, was what reason is there for keeping him now? And I can't think of one. And I'm normally sort of manager loyal, and I've been very sort of forgiving up to this point in time. But I'm just looking at it and going, this team is getting worse. The longer he manages this, the team is getting worse. Which I don't quite know how you're achieving that. And it's also that thing of, like, I suppose the comparison with Wenger is particularly apt, because towards the end with Wenger, you're looking at a go, you know, you'd spent most time with Wenger going, okay, I can see what you're doing, but, you know, it was the annual thing, wasn't it? Well, we just need one more player in this position, or we just need a really good holding midfielder, or a really good centre-half, or, like, someone who can play on the left.
There was, or just that, having everyone healthy all the
yeah,
time.
Like, there was one or two players away, but you could see what the vibe was. And then towards the end, you were kind of like, you got to the point of going, I'm not quite sure what you're trying to do anymore. And Unai Emery's managed to get to the I don't know what you're doing anymore stage after basically about a year. And it's so disheartening, because the way the team's set up in pre-season, yes, of course, they're friendlies against either weaker or less prepared teams. But the way the team approached those games, and then you look at what's happened since day one of the Premier League season, and you're like, I don't see how A led to B, if you know what I mean.
You know, yeah, exactly.
Normally you attempt to play something that has some relationship with what you're actually planning to play in the season. But, you know, who knows what went on behind the scenes. But, yeah.
I mean, only argument I would have, and kind of, you know, remotely just a bit understand, is that fact that you don't want to change managers too quickly. Yeah. Like we saw with United, what happened with them after Ferguson and everything. But yeah, I just sometimes it's just waiting too long that does more damage than going to Manchester quickly.
Well, indeed. And I'm glad I'm not the one that has to make those decisions on a regular basis.
Most definitely.
Okay, well, I think I'll take a little bit of a pause, and then we're going to give you Sylvain's update about the women's team, because obviously there's been a lot going on with the women's teams, and then we're going to come back with questions from you.
So here I'm going to speak about our women team, who are having a good season so far, and obviously the news are better than with the men's team, and coach Joe Montemurro is doing a great job again this season. So if we start with the league results, we are currently in second place with 12 points. We are level with Manchester City in second place. We have the same goal difference, actually, but we score more goals. And Chelsea are 1 point ahead of us with 13 points. Obviously, we lost against them in the league 2-1, but we then managed to proceed to beat Manchester City in the next game to redress the balance. So 1 point is nothing at that part of the season, because we've only played 5 games out of 22, so it's a long way to go. This season, obviously, we are the holders, so all the teams seem to be prepared against us, so it makes it extra hard, and the players are trying to find some solutions, and the coach as well, to go around the defenses that are more and more prepared against our attacking schemes. So in terms of league, Manchester City are in third place, the same points as us. Man United are actually in fourth place with 9 points, and they are closing on the top three now. Everton are also on 9 points, which is a big surprise, and Tottenham actually are also on 9, so you get 3 teams who are tied in third place. Then you see in seventh place, West Ham and Reading both have 6 points. Birmingham City, who managed to get their first win, are in ninth place with 3 points. And then the bottom three teams have not managed to win a game, with Bristol City on 2 points, Brighton also on 2 points, and Liverpool at the bottom of the table with 1 point in 5 games, who are in big trouble. Reading and Birmingham City have a game in hand, so Reading could actually come to the third place should they win by a large margin against Birmingham. There's only one team being relegated, so it's a battle between three teams from Bristol, Brighton and Liverpool, and the first team who will win a game basically take a big advantage over the other team. So positive news on the league side, obviously we are the holders, so we are expected challenge. Chelsea and Manchester City are there as expected, and the good news is probably in two seasons, actually three teams are likely to qualify for the Champions League as well. To have more teams from the big countries in the competition. So the Women's Champions League will look a bit like the men's, and they are looking to reintroduce the group stage as we used to have 6-7 years ago in the Women's Champions League. Although the format at the time was 3 games in a week and only one location, and now they're looking at having the same format as the men with 6 games in the group stage and then the knockout round. Then we have the Champions League situation where the team has done extremely well. They beat Slavia Praha 13-2 on aggregate this round, so it was an easy win. And obviously the away game was a bit of a strange game with the team being 5-0 up and then dropping their level to concede 2 goals. But the home game was really formality, and 8-0 win was really, really good for the girls. So it's the final 18, so let's have a look at who we can play by alphabetical order, by the way. So Arsenal, we are previous winners. Quarterfinals record is 1-6 and lost 6, actually. It's quite funny. Obviously, we are back in the competition after a 5-year absence, which was really disappointing for the fans. Then one of the opponents will be Atletico Madrid. Their previous best result is actually quarterfinal, so that's their best result this season. There is a second Spanish team as well in the competition, which is Barcelona, who have reached the final last year, and they were hammered by Lyon 4-1 in the final, and hopefully they're looking to do better this year, and we played them in pre-season and lost to them. Then another team we lost to in pre-season in FC Bayern München. Their best record is a semi-final, and we also lost to them in pre-season at home in the Emirates Cup. We also nicked 6 players of them in 2 seasons, so it should be a fun game if we play them again. Then there is the underdog team, Glasgow City from Scotland, who are the only team who are not fully professional, so therefore it's really hard for them, and this is their best result reaching the quarterfinals. They did it in 2015 as well, and they actually clinched their 13th Scottish title in a row, which is really impressive. Obviously, that would be the best draw for the Arsenal, and it would be an easy away trip as well. A tougher draw would be the holders Lyon, who have won the tournament 6 times in total, and 4 times older at the moment, so they are really, really tough. Although they have changed coach this season because they sacked the coach who did the treble last year, actually, Renal Pedros, and they have replaced him with the former professional Jean-Luc Vasseur. So we will see if Vasseur can put his ideas in place and carry on making them great. Important to note that Ada Egerberg became the all-time top scorer in the Champions League with 53 goals last week, so always a danger, the Norwegian striker, who also won the Ballon d'Or last season. Then the other French team in the competition is Paris Saint-Germain, who were runner-up a few years ago. They have improved this season thanks to a very good transfer window where they added a couple of quality players, and so they're a bit stronger than last year when they lost to Chelsea. And finally, the last but not least team is Wolfsburg, the German team, who are actually double winners, and they are strong as Lyon, basically, so if we could avoid them, that would be great. Also, Wolfsburg is not the best place to reach, and so you have to fly to Hanover and then take a train, so that's not the nicest away trip for the fans. And we have a lot of very committed fans this season, and they are singing their heart out, and it's really nice to see so many fans at away games everywhere. And I'm sure the players like it as well. So now, if we look at the other competition, we also are playing in the Continental Cup. And yesterday we drew against Brighton and lost on a penalty shootout. So the situation is simple. After 3 games, we are top of the group with 7 points. Bristol have also 7 points. Brighton have 5 points. London Bees have 5 points with Charlton 1 point and London City Lionesses 2 points. So basically 4 teams can qualify: Arsenal, Bristol, Brighton and London Bees. We just need to win one of the remaining games against Bristol or London Bees and we will go through. The Conti Cup is actually very good for squad rotation, so I think it's important to note that this year the squad is slightly stronger than last year, and Joe Montemuro has really refrained from using the academy players, unlike last year where he gave them a lot of playing time. This season 2 of them have been used: Melissa Phillips, who played 90 minutes, and Ruby Grant, who played 25 minutes. So at the moment, we have 18 senior players who are fit. So Joe Montemuro is actually trying to give game time to every player. So if you look at the math, we have a total of 1,080 minutes played so far. And funnily enough, he has split the goalkeeper's time at exactly half-half with Zinsberger and Perro Magnin at 540 minutes each, which is really interesting because he doesn't seem to have a real number one selected. Also, we could think that Zinsberger is the number one because choice because she actually starts the big games rather than Perro Magnin, who gets seen in the rotation. Interestingly, the player with the most playing time is Beth Mead with 1,006. Then Jennifer Beatty, Kim Little, Daniel Van de Donk, Katie McCabe, Leah Williamson, Jill Hord, Lisa Evans, Vivian Miedema, Jordan Knobs, Leonie Meyer. At the bottom of the pile, you get Emma Mitchell, who unfortunately doesn't get much of a game these days. She started two games in the County Cup and came back four times as a sub. So she plays barely 253 minutes out of 1,080. So she's basically the third choice at left back this season, poor Emma. Catherine Weyer has also played 260 minutes. She was injured for the first month of the competition and she has started three games for 260 minutes. One player who might be disappointed actually is Ruth Quinn because she was very high on the list last season. Actually number four in terms of total minutes played. And this year she's really at the bottom of the pile. She started three games and came on the sub four times for a total of 300 minutes. So it must be hard for her coming from being a first choice and relegated to be the third or fourth choice center back at the club. Jennifer Beatty obviously has taken her place, and as we saw, Jennifer Beatty has the second playing time for the whole squad. So it's quite obvious that Luis Kuhn has really lost a lot of playing time, and it must be surprising for her, even if there is competition inside the team, to come from the fourth best player in terms of time to the bottom of the pile, basically. So, in terms of attacking players, Joe Montemuro does try to rotate, all sharing the minutes also due to injuries and return from injuries. We can see that the best midfield three is obviously Lea Volting, Jordan Knobs and Kim Little, so it means if you compare to last season, Katie McCabe has now gone to play at the back, at left back rather than play up front. And Daniel Van de Donk, who was playing in the middle last season when Jordan Lam was injured, is now playing on the wing. So with McCabe dropping from the wing to left back and Van de Donk from center midfield to right winger, we now have the backbone of the team with obviously Beth Mead and Vivian Medema up front as key players. And in defense, Leonie Meyer actually has taken the starting place at right back, so it's quite actually difficult to know how the team is set up because Lisa Evans was also a key starter last year, still plays either at right back or on the wing as well. So it's all part of the rotation driven by Joe Montemuro. So he's really trying to rotate probably 14 or 15 players out of the 18 that are regulars, because Schneider, Beck, Quinn and Veilleux and Mitchell are really just there as rotating players. We can also note that obviously Dan Carter and Tabe Akemi are still not playing due to long-term injuries. So when those two players are actually coming back, Joe Montemuro will have 20 senior players to select from, and which will mean leaving two players at home every game and not even to make the bench. So I think I got an idea who will be those two players, unfortunately. So that was it. The women's team is really in great shape. All the players are now going on international duty, and it's really impressive because our 18 fit players are all going on international duty actually. So there must be not many players remaining at London Colney beside the injured one for national break. And hopefully we will actually break the curse, as in every international break in the previous time, one player has come back injured and he has given the coach a lot of problems with. So out of the 18 players, hopefully no one will come back injured and be ready, because the next game is a North London Derby at the new White Hart Lane, and I'm sure the players and the fans will be up for it.
Right, welcome back everyone. As promised, we've had some questions from listeners and we'll try and address them as best we can. So without further ado, Anita, do you have one to, you want to kick us off with?
Well, yeah, I'll go with the first one that's on my list. It's from Bobby at Boblex, who asks, do the cannons outside the Arsenal work? If so, how fast can we shoot Emery out of North London using them?
sadly, I have to say that the cannons don't work, Bobby. Unfortunately, that would probably be massively illegal. But also, why waste good gunpowder? I'm sure there'd be easier ways. Just kind of, I don't know, get him a taxi, get him an Uber. But it's, yeah, I mean, it would be quite funny to see, you know, I mean, one of those human cannonball suits with one of those helmets, you know, like from like some 1970s TV program with like a net somewhere in the distance and some, you know, see the amazing
flying
good evening. Yes. Which, of course, is what apparently loads of the youth players have been taking the piss out of his accent, if you believe one particular story leaked from the training ground, which may or may not be true, like a lot of other bullshit this week. Okay, well, I'm going to come back with another one, one that hopefully I can give a slightly more useful response to, which is, well, this is one that might be for you, Anita. How are you feeling about your Spanish?
Ooh. I haven't spoken it in a while.
Well, I bet you've spoken it more recently than I have. So Simon at Simon1854 asks, hi Matthew, asking for a friend. What's Spanish for you don't know what you're doing? Now, I believe you may have consulted another Spanish expert on this one. So
yeah, I asked Paul, who is our go-to Spanish guy. He lives in Bilbao.
Yeah. So do you feel like you're ready to give it a punt?
Yeah, sure. So Paul said it's, I have to say it has upside down exclamation point at the beginning, and it goes something like "Tú no sabes lo que haces," or "No sabes lo que estás haciendo."
Oh, can we get that second one again?
No sabes lo que estás haciendo.
Ah, does it scan? I don't know. We'll have to try and put it to music later. But anyway, thanks for bringing that to life for us, Anita. And, of course, thanks, Simon, for the question. And any more questions from you, Anita?
Well, yeah, the one that we kind of talked about, but we haven't really talked about names in particular. Top three candidates to replace Emery if Gunnar Saros turns down the job. Asks Matthew Coleman at Matthew Coleman.
It's Matthew underscore Coleman.
Underscore. I couldn't remember the whole sentence.
Okay, top three candidates to replace
Being native
Emery.
In English.
Okay, do you have a top three in mind? I mean, I have to say it's... does that include Freddy Ljungberg as a caretaker to the end of the season? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that would be... ideally, I would go with that, you know, have someone caretaker as a caretaker until the end of the season and then go for the proper, you know, full-time, long-term replacement this summer. But I would definitely put the Max Leiter, which you mentioned before, on that list. And I would go back to the fan popular Mikel Arteta as well.
Well, I think Arteta's not going to be possible to the end of the season. So it's interesting. I mean, I think if on a short-term contract, I'd be willing to take a punt on quite a lot of people, but I don't know how many of those managers would be after a short-term contract. So, like you, I'd very much look at the caretaker manager idea, simply because there isn't anyone that is currently available to break their to join us immediately that strikes me as an obvious long-term option. They don't seem like massively good fits for the club. Like Allegri is clearly a really good manager, but Juventus had such dominant resources compared to the rest of Italian clubs and inherited this incredibly well-built defence that Conte had put together. And that's not to do down Allegri. I mean, he showed even at Milan that he was a decent coach. But I don't know how he would do in the situation we are here. I mean,
That said, we don't know how Arteta would do or how Ljungberg would do, because, hey, at least unlike them, he's managed at the top level and with incredible success. I mean, I'd take him ahead of Mourinho every day of the week.
Or anyone.
But it's trying to work out, you know, who would fit into the playing squad we have. Because I think one of the problems with Emery is that Emery ball doesn't really fit some of the players we've got. You can see it working for some, but not for others. And so it's who wants to play attacking possession-based football where you've got technical security in the middle, and then out wide you've got something a bit more direct. So, like, there's no one immediately that springs to mind for me, which is obviously shit and is not really helping. I suppose that for me, I'd quite like to know if Luis Enrique, following obviously the tragic death of his daughter, would be looking for a managerial role again. Because I think he could be a good fit. And obviously he's already got a relationship with Raul Sinyehi. He probably would have come into some contact with Francisco Cajigao when he was at Barcelona. So there may be something in that. He's an option I'd quite like the club to look at, because I think also the way he wants to play football, given that when he was at Barcelona, he tried to meld their tiki-taka possession to something a bit more direct. And I think that could be a good fit for the squad we have at disposal now. So I guess I'd go for caretaker first option, Luis Enrique second option, and then Allegri as a third option.
Good shot. So no Gunnarsaurus then?
No. Well, the thing about Gunnarsaurus is... I think with those claws, he'd have a bitch getting the zip-up coat done, particularly in the winter when they get cold. And also, I reckon you don't want a manager who keeps banging his head against the top of dugouts in away games. It's just not a good look. I mean, he probably knows as much about football as a lot of self-proclaimed managers on the internet, so who knows? All right, well, I've got another one I'm going to hit you with, which is, this comes from, you're probably not surprised I'm going to be asking this one, Anita. This is from The Gunners Pub, at The Gunners Pub, with capital T, capital G, capital P, The Gunners Pub, asking, should we be removing AFTV from a public concourse? Enough is enough. I mean, I've got my own thoughts, but what's yours?
Yeah, the Una from the Gunners Pub. I think she has been having some, what's the word?
Running battles?
not running, but petition. Yeah, the petition going to remove AFTV from public space around the Emirates Stadium because of everything they have done so far for the club, to the club. Well, we have seen the Arsenal react on that as well, asking them to remove their name from their channel name and everything related to that, which was definitely a show of disagreement and not really liking what they do. And we have seen, obviously, Hector Bellerin's comments as well.
Indeed.
And yes, I would definitely be for removing them and getting them rid of their jobs and how they earn money while being mean and abusive. They kind of, you know, normalized abusive behavior online on social media. And I wouldn't blame them completely for things that have been happening to Chuck as well, but I don't think they did anything to stop that, and they helped people get more abusive on social media because that gets likes and views and reactions and everything.
Yeah, it's like the live fan TV version of TalkSport Radio and that knobhead Adrian Dunham, who just basically says controversial things to wind up fans so they all phone in and make lots of money for the radio station. It's kind of the similar principle. He, who, by the way, today got called out by Fabregas because basically he implied that there were five other better Dutch footballers in the Premier League history than Bergkamp, and that was Bergkamp all that good, etc., etc. And Fabregas basically went on the internet and fucking destroyed him. Fabregas's comments actually were, is this guy serious? Lost the plot big time there. If you don't think Bergkamp was that good, then you don't understand this sport at all. And I think we can all agree with that. And it's also quite nice that now he's free of Chelsea, Cesc seems to be doing more, saying more and more nice things about Arsenal. But yeah, I mean, I'd only personally petition to remove Arsenal Fan TV from the concourse if it could involve then firing them into the heart of the sun. I mean, what gets me so angry about Arsenal Fan TV, or AFTV as we have to call them now, is when it first started, it reminds me a bit of Big Brother, the TV programme. Mm-hmm. Like, the first series of that, I was kind of like, okay, it's flawed, but it's quite an interesting idea, and it could actually bring some good, and it could be a useful, you know, that was a social experiment. AFTV could have been a useful fan outlet, could have been a great way to get fan voices. And then they suddenly noticed that people were watching, and people could get sort of well-known through it, and then it became a horrible shit show of exploitative narcissism, which is exactly what AFTV has become. And people now want to get on it so they can kind of be seen. But they still champion the most provocative opinions and the most outrageous ways of putting things. And I think, you know, and this is, for me, speaks more broadly to a lot of things. You know, it's one of the things we try and do on here, despite my potty mouth. and one of the things that I think all TV channels have a responsibility to as well, which is, you know, it's why I get so angry with the BBC at the moment, is if you're broadcasting things, you have a sort of responsibility to try and do things in a positive way that actually increases the general level of knowledge and intelligence and reflection and all that, rather than just shouting the loudest in the hope that you get looked at a lot. I mean, hey, I'm not going to criticise Robbie. You managed to come up with a good idea and then make as much money as possible out of it. But for me, it's just very sad that what should have been a good idea and a really positive thing for this football club has become a massive negative. And I would definitely kick them off the concourse, just because having them there makes them seem connected to the club.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is another thing that damages a brand that is already taking a lot of a beating for a lot of other reasons as well.
Yeah, I had people here in Croatia ask me about them, about Arsenal Fan TV, if I watched the videos and how do I react on that. Well, I haven't literally seen a single video from their YouTube. I've seen clips, you know, on YouTube, on Twitter that show up, or screenshots or something, but I haven't actually gone on their YouTube and seen any videos. But people, and usually from not supporting Arsenal, but other clubs,
yeah,
are watching that channel to make fun of us, make fun of the club, and talk about it.
Yeah, and as I say, when it first started, I watched it a bit because I was really hopeful for what it could be. And when it first started, it wasn't kind of, it was obviously clickbaity and controversial.
Yeah.
But very quickly it descended into something else, which is a shame. It's also a shame because they've got, you know, enough reach that they could get really knowledgeable, you know, really knowledgeable people on there. They could really add to the debate in a constructive way and help us all as fans become, you know, better informed, more able to actually have opinions that come from a knowledge place, while still giving that very important outlet for people to sound off. Which is, you know, of course that's really important. But for me, what it is now is it's just a cynical, exploitative thing, which is a real shame. And I hope that maybe when people eventually start to turn against it, as it will inevitably happen, that they try and use the opportunity to reposition themselves as something positive and yeah, actually be a net contributor to the Arsenal family. I mean, even down to little things like when they were doing their transfer specials or whatever in the summer and the summer before, I thought, okay, let's give them a chance. So I watched like one each year, and it was just remarkably ill-informed stuff quite a lot of the time. And I thought that was a real shame because there's so many people out there that could have contributed to them in a much more constructive fashion. Anyway, we have a really serious question that I wanted to leap onto off the back of that one, because it kind of directly relates to what you were saying about the overall culture. And this one comes from, well, I think you know who it comes from, Anita. this is from your Manchester United supporting other half.
Yes.
But actually, it's a serious question. I'll let you, as the other half, give the full name and Twitter handle.
Yeah, he's Ryo Genaku. It's his nickname on Twitter, Nicola, my boyfriend. He says, why and when did fans stop respecting managers and started supporting players like they have more knowledge and or experience? I'd rather post some shit on Instagram than adapt and play how my coach instructed me until he gets sacked. That was in quotes.
Yes. General question.
Good general question, yeah.
I mean,
really serious, really deep.
Yeah. I mean, Jesus, have you had a bad weekend, you two?
Well, United lost, Arsenal drew. So.
Yeah. It's true. I mean, there's always that. We've always got that, boys and girls. I mean, I think that it's a tricky one because I don't know what it's like for fans of other clubs, particularly outside of the UK. I think certainly the rise of social media and basically the online world, you know, it has an amazing power for good because people can express opinions, people can share information, people can get access to information. So we're all so much better informed if we choose to be than we were, you know, when I was growing up. You know, you can find out anything, something about almost anything pretty quickly. But of course, there's a lot more shit to sift through. And I guess a bit like with Arsenal Fan TV, I shouldn't be too critical as I'm also putting stuff out into the ether via this medium. But I would say that it has, the lack of accountability associated with social media has let people become more and more virulent in their opinions. And I don't think it's limited to football at all. I think it's what we see in football is a symptom of, I mean, you just have to go on the post something on Twitter about Brexit and put a few hashtags on whichever side of the argument on, and just wait for people to start telling you to die. So I think there is a lot more kind of people feeling they've got their right to have their say, and also the fact that we are more, have more access to information, makes us all feel more informed. So I can sit here talking about Unai Emery's tactics, but I've never been a football manager, so all I can do is rely on my observation, which playing a lot of Football Manager on the computer and talking to other people who have been football coaches, in the hope that together that creates some sort of cohesive picture. But you know, I would love to be Arsenal manager, but pretend that I'd have the first idea what I'm doing is obviously ludicrous, because I've never coached anyone. But I think more generally, I think certainly in the UK, it reflects a trend in the UK society, even off social media. There's tolerance, patience, and respect are definitely on the decline in certain and very significant parts of our society. And you look at the political debate in the UK at the moment, and you know, obviously America's another point, and there are other countries where I'm sure it applies as well at the moment. You know, everything's getting more polarized. People want to be angry about stuff. Is it, you know, and then you get into broader philosophical questions there. Is that because, you know, we're feeling disappointed in our lives in general because the great glorious future we were promised 20 years ago has not really materialised for us all because we're all getting fucked over by massive multinational corporations who will squeeze us dry and not pay any tax? Is it because we don't feel, we're too comfortable and feel life doesn't feel like it has a purpose, so we've got a desperate to have opinions? Is it because we're desperate for gratification, so we figure if we pick a tribe, people will side with us and we can have that unity of some sort? Is it we're just trying to provoke a reaction? There's a lot of things to unpack in it, but I mean, what do you reckon?
I think that when it comes to, you know, just the football side of things, I will steer away from Brexit and everything.
It's always a good idea.
I think there has been, it has lots to do with the whole marketing and advertisements and everything happening around players rather than clubs in general, and particularly managers as well, because you see like big sponsors, like even, you know, kit manufacturers and everything, boots, who are making boots as well, picking out their players and creating some kind of like a cult of personality around certain players, like you have Cristiano Ronaldo, obviously Leo Messi, and other smaller players in that. And you obviously, there have been people around the whole world, perhaps not so many in the UK as around the world, who have been supporting a player rather than a club. And I think it's not that uncommon to happen around the world, especially when you look on the perhaps the Far East and that market that has been opened up lately. They like players. They support players. They go, follow Cristiano Ronaldo everywhere he goes and everything like that. So I think that the commercialism of the players, of the everything that they have been doing and sponsorships and marketing altogether has had a really big influence on that, that people tend to support players more than clubs and managers who are in charge.
I totally agree. And that also raises the sort of the question of, you know, who are our heroes? And at the end of the day, unless a manager is incredibly successful or incredibly charismatic or both, it's much harder for them to be a hero than a player because, most players are living out very publicly some kind of dreams that we associate either for ourselves projecting or in terms of, you know, achieving things for our club or country. And, of course, also players can achieve great... players tend to move clubs slightly more than managers, unless you're like Alan Pardew or Sam Allardyce. And also... players can achieve success with their national teams and in a way that managers can't manage a club and a national team at the same time very often. So someone like Mesut Ozil, who is obviously being partly referenced in this, but I'm sure Paul Pogba was too, they're both players who've won a World Cup.
Yes.
And been a really important part of a World Cup winning team and have done and have been brilliant for their country. And not just in that tournament as well, but at other times as well. And they've both played for major European clubs. So these are players that, you know, in the grand scheme of things, have achieved an enormous amount. And most managers won't have achieved an equivalence.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, obviously you get the people like Mourinho when he was at his peak, or you got Ferguson, or you got Wenger, or you've got... I mean, Zidane's different because he was obviously a legend as a player and then won three Champions League as a manager, so he's in a different category. But even Guardiola was a very fine player, but he's a manager and he's a cult hero figure. Klopp, you know, these figures, they transcend that. And then if it's the player against that kind of manager, the player is toast because those managers have such success but also have very strong relationships with fans and kind of have their own cults of personality around them as well. But for most, you know, unless you're like a manager at that level or unless you're being incredibly successful with your club, you are not going to have the same status.
Yeah.
And of course, it's magnified when you're in a situation like Arsenal are with Emery not picking Ozil, or, you know, Mourinho falling out with players as he does every so often, or Solskjaer struggling to get the best out of Man United, you know, and Pogba being a bit demotivated by the situation there. You know, it's in the same way as also a manager is much easier to replace than players. You know, a manager you can just fire and get another one, whereas you can't just fire a player because he's a massive asset. So there's another element in it as well. You know, clubs by necessity, as well as fans, have to have a slightly greater loyalty to players unless they've got a manager that's really established and doing really well. But it's a good question, Matt. I liked that. We've got another question. Have you got access to either of our final two questions?
Yeah, the one that came in while we started recording this podcast is by Darren Boyle at Mr. Scoop, who asks, should we wait for the defeat at Leicester before sacking Emery?
Well, I mean, we're going to.
Definitely.
I mean, they're not going to replace him. And also, actually, even though people might say that it'd be a loss of momentum and... the team's top four chances might suffer as a result, ultimately, after that, there's an international break. And if you are going to make a change, it's a lot easier to do it then. We've seen that with plenty of other clubs that gives you a chance to take stock and take a more unified opinion amongst those people involved in the decision-making process, and also give you the time, the chance for whoever comes in to not have their first game being a potentially season-defining game away against a team in much better form.
I really don't see how it could do much harm, much more than Emery has been doing at the moment. Because, I mean, we have seen, like, most recently when United signed Ole, when he took over in the middle of the season. It gave them a really nice push and players were motivated and, you know, like a positive shock, something like that. I think that could happen here as well, because we all know that these players can play well and are capable of a lot more than they are showing at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those things that the issues are slightly different, because obviously when Solskjaer came in, everyone fucking hated Mourinho and just wanted him gone, bar one or two players.
Nice reminder for those who want Mourinho at Arsenal as well.
Exactly. We've got a question on that coming up. Obviously, you know, Solskjaer came in as a good guy. Everyone loved him, loves the club. So that had that feel-good factor until he signed a new contract and suddenly the wheels fell off immediately. So, the difference is at Arsenal, Emery has some of the players seem to have gone cool in him a bit. Others seem very loyal to him. It's less of a cut and dried thing, but you'd need, if someone was to come in at short notice, it needs to be someone who has a force of personality to change the atmosphere. Right, it's, you know, I think the atmosphere needs changing almost as much as the technical side of things as well, simply because, you know, the players are not stupid. They're going to know how people are feeling negative about the team, and they're not going to be happy if the team's been playing at a mediocre level and drawing and losing games, because to be a footballer at the top level, you have to be an elite athlete with a competitive spirit that is far outstrips most normal people. And so, yeah, whatever change has to be done, it has to harness that.
Yeah.
And there's a final question, which is, again, another one from Bobby Chakrabarty, Boblex, which is a slight visual clue, but it's basically, with Jose Mourinho linked to Arsenal, is your thought the same as mine? Please see picture below. Picture says, first we'll kill it with fire, then we'll nuke the fucker just to make sure. I mean, I wouldn't go quite that strong. thing is, what I'd say is, if you could convince Mourinho to sign an end-to-the-season-only contract, he'd probably be really good for Arsenal, because he's got the clout and he needs to rebuild his reputation. He knows it, so he'd be a very good boy. But if you thought about giving him a three-year contract, no fucking way. No fucking way.
No. I'd rather have 5 more years of 30 plus shots conceded than a week with Mourinho.
I mean, if we just want to play as exciting football, maybe we could see if Spurs have still got Ozzy Ardiles' phone number anywhere, and just go mad for it. Just go, I don't know, we'll play 5 up front. Fuck it. Yeah, we'll play Pepe, Ozil, Lacazette, Aubameyang, and Saka all at the same time. And then we'll have no one back, and we'll have Torreira having to do 40-yard shuffle runs every second. All right, guys. Well, I think this is already going to be an epic length podcast, particularly as we've yapped on about all kinds of things. But there's been quite a lot going on in the Arsenal this week, not just with the men's team, but also with the women's team. And of course, we have to give your questions the honour they deserve. So looking forward, obviously we do have to consider the fact that there's two games coming up this week. There's away at Vitória, who obviously we got our last minute winner against in the home game. Our kickoff time for the Europa League has been changed to an unusual time, so it's actually been kicking off at 10 to 4
on Wednesday.
Yeah, that's British time, which is, yeah.
Just when I get home from work.
Apparently it's to avoid traffic congestion in Portugal. So there we go. So if those of you have managed to get an office on your own, or you can get it on your phone, maybe have a look at that. But I suppose the big one we have to look forward to is
Leicester. Look forward to.
Yeah.
That's nice.
So do you see any hope of us getting anything out of the Leicester game, Anita?
No, but I mean, I didn't see any hope in the Liverpool match, and I was surprised. Maybe I will be surprised next weekend as well. I don't see it, but maybe.
I reckon we might scrape away with an inconclusive draw that doesn't move the situation forward, but also leaves it no one happy.
2-2, huh?
Yeah, probably. Simply because also, with the league positions, maybe Emery will treat it like a big game. and he tends to do slightly better in those comparatively.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we should all see. We'll speak to you about that next week, of course, listeners, to recap the Vitória game in the Europa League. And, of course, a slightly shit-scary game against Leicester City at 5:30 on Saturday. That's 5:30 on Saturday, because for some reason our Europa League game this week is Wednesday, because, hey, why keep things consistent? So, nothing to say except thanks again to Anita.
Yeah, it was...
It was. Yeah. It happened. Thanks again to Sylvain for his flying report from Arsenal Women. And thanks again to you listeners for both your questions and also for listening to us every week. And if you don't listen to us every week, that's fine too. I won't take offence. It's okay. Right. Have a great week, everyone. Take care.
Bye-bye.